Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Copper Bullets. The four-part series from Amazing Sports Stories is available now.
Zambia was considered as an underdog.
Are we going to do the impossible here?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 22nd of June. Four members of the billionaire Hinduja family are given jail sentences in Switzerland for exploiting domestic servants. Ukraine says fighting to defend the strategic town of Chasiv Yar has become extremely difficult. And the Namibian High Court strikes down colonial-era laws criminalising gay sex between men. Also in the podcast, 27 years on, the Kyoto Protocol is dramatised on stage.
This utterly incredible, dramatic, moving story. When 176 countries came together and agreed on something that really they shouldn't have agreed on.
And JFK's watch goes under the hammer more than 80 years after he lost it gambling. It is a stunning verdict. Four members of Britain's richest family have been sentenced to jail terms of at least 4 years for exploiting immigrant staff at their mansion in Switzerland. The Hindujas, thought to be worth nearly $50 billion, were accused of spending more on their pets than on the servants that they brought over from their native India. The Swiss court cleared them of human trafficking, but convicted the four of taking advantage of vulnerable staff. Prosecutors pursued the case despite the family reaching an out-of-court settlement with the servants. The family's lawyer said he was shocked by the sentence and would appeal.
I have the feeling that the behaviour was judged on moral grounds and not on legal grounds. On the one hand, you have a very wealthy family, and on the other, poor people. Objectively, therefore, it's a kind of punishment for this gap between the two groups of people.
The four Hindujas are currently reported to be in Monaco, and it's not clear if they'll be extradited to Switzerland. I heard more about the trial from our Geneva correspondent, Imogen Folks.
Well, it was pretty sad, depressing evidence that came out in this case, that the Hindujas were paying these staff really a pittance, a fraction of what the Geneva minimum wage is. We're talking things like $7 or $8 a day. And this was paid directly to accounts in India in rupees, so the staff couldn't even access it. One of the complainants testified that she worked for them for years but had to sleep in a cellar and that they were restricted from leaving the house. So a very, very depressing story.
Yeah, will the Hindujas go to jail?
Well, that's what the judge has asked for. We were a bit surprised, the journalists covering this case. We thought, well, there'd be a big fine, possibly. But the judge has asked for custodial sentences of up to 4.5 years for all four of them. Now, of course, it appears none of them are in Switzerland, although the younger two Hindujas were in court this week. They're reportedly all four in Monaco. It's not clear whether they will be extradited to Switzerland. Their defence lawyer has suggested also that they will appeal.
Does this case have wider implications for the treatment of domestic staff in Switzerland?
I think it's going to be a warning to some of the very wealthy people in Geneva that the authorities in Geneva aren't going to tolerate this anymore, because frankly, it's a bit of an open secret that this kind of thing happens. It's not the first case that I or many of my colleagues have heard of, that they're very, very wealthy people, business people or people who stay in the five-star hotels, who bring servants from their home country sometimes and then treat them very badly. And I think the authorities in Geneva with this case are saying, no, that's not how things are done.
The family's lawyer say they will appeal. What would be the likely time frame for that kind of thing?
Could be quite a long time. We've literally just had this verdict in the last couple of hours, and it was a surprise to all of us who'd expected to see the younger two Hindujas again in court, as we saw them already this week, that they weren't there. Now, as I said, we hear all four of them are in Monaco. So it could take quite a while, but the prosecutor has asked for this custodial sentence, and for the younger two Hindujas at least, to be detained pending that.
Imogen Folks in Switzerland. One of Russia's war aims in Ukraine is to take the whole of the Donbass. As part of its offensive there, Russian troops fought two long and bloody battles for the cities of Bakhmut and Avdiivka. But their current assault on the much smaller Chasiv Yar could be more strategically important. The invaders have been trying to take the hilltop town, about 10 kilometres west of Bakhmut, since February. But the fighting has now become extremely difficult, according to Ukrainian units redeployed there, with the Russians trying to attack both head-on and to encircle the town. I heard more from Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor at BBC Monitoring.
Ukrainian forces are facing a shortage of everything. Drones, medical evacuation vehicles, artillery shells, tanks. There are more Russians, they are better equipped, and, OK, it costs Russia a lot as well in terms of manpower to try and take Chasiv Yar. But for the Ukrainians, it's a really difficult situation.
And they're still facing those shortages despite the US unblocking that $61 billion worth of equipment.
That's correct, and we knew all along that it is going to take some time before there's a tangible difference made by those funds released by the United States. Having said that, after the United States allowed Ukraine to use American weaponry and ammunition to target Russian territory adjacent to the Ukrainian cities that Russia's been targeting, there's been a decrease in the bombing and shelling of Kharkiv, for example, which is a welcome respite for the Ukrainians. Elsewhere, one thing I keep hearing about are massive and long power outages affecting people and cities that didn't have them before. I've been speaking to people in Zaporizhia in the east and in the capital, Kiev, and they're saying every day, at least twice a day, there are outages lasting 3 to 4 hours. And this means no lifts, in some cases no running water, no toilets, no Wi-Fi possibly, no air conditioning. And it's getting really, really hot. And even though this is summer, Ukrainians shudder thinking about how things are going to get in the winter.
If Chasiv Yar falls to the Russians, what would that mean for the battle for Donbass?
It will open the way for Russians to other towns and cities elsewhere in Donbass and eastern Ukraine. I know we keep talking about all these towns and cities as having strategic importance, but Chasiv Yar, even though it's smaller than the other towns and cities that Russia has taken, such as Avdiivka and Bakhmut, it sits on top of a series of hills overlooking terrain for miles around, and it has been turned by the Ukrainians into a massive fortress, precisely because they want to stop Russians from advancing further west. So if Chasiv Yar falls, it opens up the way for the Russians to try and advance onto Kramatorsk and Slovyansk and smaller towns and villages. But overall, this would mean that Russia's slow and bloody advance throughout eastern Ukraine, it continues.
Can they hold it?
Potentially. They've been holding for months and the hopes that all those fresh supplies will reach them before they get overwhelmed by the Russians. But time will tell, frankly.
Vitaly Shevchenko from BBC Monitoring. A man is thought to have been killed by a bear in central Japan. If confirmed, it'd be just the latest in a surge in attacks by the creatures as they venture more often into populated areas. I got the details from Will Leonardo.
Well, this suspected attack happened in a place called Nagano. It's a prefecture in the centre of Japan. It's picturesque. It's known for its woods and mountains. A construction company worker went looking for a missing colleague and found his body in the forest with large wounds to his head and back, which officials are saying are consistent with bear attacks. The victim was 58 years old. And investigations are continuing, but if it's confirmed that this was a bear attack, which it seems likely, this would be the fifth attack in the prefecture of Nagano this month alone.
Now, bear numbers were once in severe decline. In fact, they were almost at risk of extinction. They're back in a big way. Why are these attacks increasing now?
Stories about bears pop up now in Japanese media with incredible regularity. Sometimes it's a kind of standoff in a street or a curious bear sort of encroaching into a garden. But more and more, as you say, it's these gruesome cases of severe attacks. In the year to March this year alone, there were more than 200 attacks recorded across Japan, which is a record for the country, and six people died. The bears in question are mostly Asian black bears. They're native to Japan. Their numbers had once been in severe decline because of hunting, but they now number it in the tens of thousands. And that's happened at the same time that Japan's rural population of humans has been declining as young people move to the cities, and obviously Japan's experiencing a shrinking birth rate. And that's caused what scientists have described as a blurring of traditional boundaries. These bears are competing for fewer resources. They're coming out of their traditional habitats for food into places that are less populated with humans. And they also seem to be hibernating less. For example, in Hokkaido in the north, which is actually home to brown bears, which are bigger than the native the black bears in other parts of Japan, salmon numbers, which they feed on, have shrunk dramatically. So they're kind of looking around for food more and more. And one interesting theory is that the sound of children in these villages in the rural parts of Japan has traditionally been a kind of ward to keep bears at bay, you know, the sound of them playing, whatever it might be. But there just aren't that many children anymore in places like Nagano.
So what can be done to try to reduce these number of attacks?
Well, Japanese officials are kind of upping their tone. They're kind of issuing warnings to say that in some parts, bears appear to be seeing humans as prey for the first time. Bears that have developed a fondness for meat, so if they've been attacking cows or other livestock, are seen as particularly dangerous. The Environment Ministry warns people in these areas now with regularity to get rid of their food waste because that can attract bears, keep their doors closed. And officials in Toyama Prefecture are even using artificial intelligence. There's a pilot system that was launched there recently which uses AI to help monitor bear movements through security cameras and other forms of cameras and sends warnings to residents when they're seen.
And I was talking to Will Leonardo. The High Court in Namibia has struck down two colonial-era laws that criminalised same-sex acts between men. There was no similar ban for women. The case was lodged by a Namibian gay rights activist. The BBC's gender and identity correspondent for Africa, Esther Ogola, explained the significance of the ruling.
Simply means that what many in the LGBTQ community would call state-sanctioned homophobia has been dropped. This basically means that no one can use laws, including the government, to deny people rights to live together or to access any form of service simply because they are a same-sex couple.
And couples who got married outside Namibia, what about them?
It just so happens that in 2023, and this had started even before 2023, Namibia's constitutional court told the government that they were obligated to recognize same-sex marriages from foreign countries where same-sex marriages were legal. This was brought forward by two couples who, when they got into Namibia, the government refused to give their partners residency. And so they took it to court. And the constitutional court said, while they are not saying that in Namibia, marriages between same-sex couples are recognized, marriages from other countries where same-sex marriages are recognized will be recognized in Namibia.
Give us a sense then, as you've covered this story for many years, how significant the ruling is.
Bias against the LGBTQ community around the continent is very rampant and rife, and there's been a lot of instances of discrimination, including violence, where people have been attacked simply for being same-sex couples or for being members of the LGBTQ community.
In practical terms then, in Namibia, from now on, if there is a same-sex couple, how would they be able to live their life visibly in a different way they were unable to before the ruling?
Maybe two things. There's the law and there's also, you know, cultural attitudes. And sometimes changing the cultural attitudes is harder than changing the law. And so what it means is, I think people can now seek redress in case of anything that is against the law. But culturally also, I think people still need to, you know, sort of understand members of the LGBTQ community. They may not necessarily be able to live fully because maybe the communities around them have not fully accepted them and may still have bias against them. But what it means is, in case of anything, whether it's violence or discriminatory, they can now seek redress in courts because their rights have been violated.
The BBC's gender and identity correspondent for Africa, Esther Ogola, talking to James Reynolds. And still to come on the Global News podcast, why the American government has banned the Russian cybersecurity firm Kaspersky Lab from selling its antivirus software in the US.
I'm Crancy Twig from the Global Jigsaw podcast, where we are asking, is the Islamic State group a threat once more? 10 years since they declared the establishment of a caliphate, the jihadists are claiming to be behind a spate of recent terror attacks.
You cannot ignore the danger of IS. When you're not looking, they will rebound and regroup.
The Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring looks at the world through the lens of its media. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Much of the current fighting in the civil war in Sudan is in the western region of Darfur. The paramilitary rapid support forces are besieging El Fasher, the last city there held by the regular army. One of the most important figures in Darfur is Abdul Wahid al-Nur, leader of an armed group that controls territory nearby, but which has so far stayed neutral. Now there are reports suggesting that large numbers of people have fled from around El Fasher into the area controlled by Abdul Wahid al-Nur. James Copnell asked him if this was true.
You know that we are providing to them security. We're providing security very well for them. But we are not able, because you feel helpless, that you are not able to provide shelter, food, water, medicines. It is a catastrophe. It is a nightmare. There's a real humanitarian catastrophe, running out of any food, anything, any life assistance to them. It is really catastrophic. And this is not only in Darfur or the Balmara or under control area. This is across the country.
I was going to ask you about that, because all over Sudan, and we've been talking about it for weeks now, millions of people are at risk of famine. People are struggling to find their next meal. So what about in the areas you control? Is it possible to get food in? Are you able to grow enough food to feed people? Or are people starving to death?
For the moment, we don't have, because UN is very bureaucrats. And the matter of fact, in Sudan today, they're talking about sovereignty. And the matter of fact, there is a forced sovereignty in Sudan. There is SPLM North, led by General Abdelaziz Al-Hilu. Their control of South Kordofan, Nuba Mountain, and Blue Nile. There is SAF in East Sudan and North Sudan. And there is Rapid Support Force. And there is us who control the region I told you. So this is a forced sovereignty. And I'm calling upon the international community that the reality is that this is a fact. We need to come cross-cut border. It will never come from Portugal, not at all. It will never come there. And even if it's there, you know that this mentality of those who ruling the war now, the last thing they think is about human life and human dignity. We need from the UN to open, in particular for this new resolution, that we want our area to be a safe haven to the people, and also the food to be distributed only to Darfur, but also to Kordofan. You know that there will not be a food or anything coming from Port Sudan to Kordofan.
Yeah, the Sudanese military in Port Sudan are unlikely to want food to go to areas controlled by rebels in South Kordofan or in Darfur.
Our strategy at the movement is that we want also to protect and to guarantee this rainy season people to shift their land. We want people to be satisfied and moreover to make a business because we want food to be there. We can't rely on UN and others to relieve the people without protecting the land. Our land is a very fertile. With the security, with the shifting of the people, their land, it means that we are creating a food security.
Abdul Wahid Al-Noor talking to James Copnell. In the late 1990s, almost every country in the world signed up to a UN agreement on climate change. The Kyoto Protocol is now widely seen as the point at which politicians agreed to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Nearly three decades on, a new play by the Royal Shakespeare Company is telling the story of how the treaty was pushed through. This report from Vincent Dowd.
I refer you to sub-item 1B of the provisional agenda for the session contained in document FCCC.
In a dull grey building in 1997, dull grey diplomacy unfurls at a climate conference in Japan. 27 years later, Kyoto, the play, in rehearsal at the RSC in Stratford-upon-Avon, digs out the drama beneath.
We cannot force the problem, you did. China will not remain poor.
The authors believe how the argument on global warming has been conducted reflects the modern attitude to almost any big controversial issue.
I'm Joe Robertson, one of the writers of Kyoto at the Royal Shakespeare Company.
And I'm Joe Murphy, the other writer.
We're both very aware of the atmosphere in the world at the moment of disagreement, of conflict. There's quite a febrile sense of things, a feeling ever more entrenched in our own sort of isolated individual cells. And we came across this story about Kyoto, about the protocol agreed in 1997, actually on BBC Radio, one of the reunion episodes. And it just seemed to us this utterly incredible, dramatic, moving story. And 176 countries came together and agreed on something that really they shouldn't have agreed on.
We'll recommend the adoption of this protocol to the conference by unanimity.
Joe Robertson and Joe Murphy needed a central figure to hold together a story which could have become a morass of technical detail.
As we did more research, talked to dozens of people who were there, read as many books on climate as we could get our hands on, we sort of discovered a character who isn't in a lot of those books, but is often in the footnotes. There's not much online about him. And we did a deep dive into this man called Don Perlman, who was an American oil lobbyist during that time. He's deceased now, but he played such a vital role in those negotiations, in preventing the progress of the negotiations.
Don Perlman's played by American actor Stephen Kunkin.
Now, I know what people like you think of lawyers like me, but I'm the only one who can tell this story because I'm the only one who was there. And if you want to know it all, you can't have it all your own way.
Don is really the narrator in the center, telling a story of agreement through the one man who didn't want it to happen, presented to us an irresistible dramatic engine.
And the U.S. will not make itself poor on the basis of a few scares.
Opposition in the Senate meant the US never ratified the agreement and Canada pulled out in 2011. Do actors Raj Rawi and Jurga Bosk think the script portrays anyone on stage as all hero or all villain?
No, I think what it does very specifically, it says, listen, you got to put yourself in the other man's shoe in this very divided world. But somehow they did reach an agreement, which was extraordinary.
We'll all use technology, we'll travel. Are you willing to stop having a car, having a phone?
How do you make 2.5 hours work on stage on this very complex topic?
A lot of energy, a lot of humour.
If you're so concerned, where's China's target timetable?
Well, we have 4 times 4 people.
The writers say their play is really about how, in a fractious world, we can find ways to debate the big questions if we try.
You really could point your finger at any issue in the newspapers or all across the media, such as gender identity, such as anything that we are discussing at the moment, and finding an appropriate and meaningful way to discuss. It is applicable to this.
Actually, how do you tell a hopeful story about climate change? How do you make people walk out of a theatre having felt something, having felt that change is possible, having actually been motivated by this incredible story? So there is a huge element of hope there.
Conference adjourned.
That report by Vincent Dowd. Now to an advert that probably won't be playing in the US today.
Your digital life matters. Protect it with the new Kaspersky. Like this guy. He gets it.
Well, he won't get it if he's in America, because the government in Washington has banned the Russian cybersecurity firm Kaspersky Lab from selling its popular antivirus software. It's also sanctioned 12 senior bosses from the firm. The US Commerce Secretary, Gina Raimondo, said the Russian government was able to use firms like Kaspersky to steal information or plant malware on American computers, something the company denies. Jen Ellis is a cybersecurity expert. James Menendez asked her, how unusual is this?
I think it's fairly unprecedented, if I'm honest. You know, we've previously had a situation where they banned it from use in the government. And we've seen that happen with other technology, right? We've seen it with Huawei, and we've seen it with TikTok. But to actually single out a single company, ban them from any commercial sales, that seems unusual to me.
And as consumers, we never really get to see the evidence, the justification for the ban, do we?
No. I have a belief that there is an evidentiary process, that there is a requirement, that they don't take these steps lightly. But as consumers know, we won't know what that looks like. It would be unlikely that they would share that information publicly.
If a government did want to hack another country's critical infrastructure, and we've seen cases, for example, in the UK with hospitals just in the past couple of weeks. I mean, presumably it can do so without hiding behind like a company such as Kaspersky, right?
I think here's the concern. There is a view that we are potentially seeing lines drawn between Western nations, sort of Europe and NATO and Five Eyes nations. And then on the other side of the line, sort of, you know, Russia, China, Iran and North Korea. And that there will be a strong cyber component to the lines being drawn and to any potential for future aggression or combat, right? And I think the view is that what we don't want to see happen is for potential what we call backdoors being planted. And that basically means that you use something you think is innocent and that you have no reason to be suspicious of, but it is providing a foothold. It's sort of, imagine a sleeper cell, right? Like a sleeper spy, but it's a technological one that you may not ever activate, or you might activate it when you need it. And I think the concern is that you could have that be really widespread in every sector of your economy, and including your critical infrastructure, and that could be catastrophic if it was then activated at some point in the future.
Which sort of suggests that it's about possibly, and we don't know, of course, future risk rather than something that's already happened. I just finally, yes. I mean, what should users do about this?
So firstly, I would say for users in this country, they should wait and see what the UK government will say and whether the UK government will also support this or will not, right? They will be doing their own research and they will be sharing information with the US government. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, if you do have Kaspersky and you are concerned, then there are other options available on the market. It might be worth having a look at what those are and trying to understand what a replacement would look like. And you also might want to go through your logs or your security data to see whether there is any indication of any activity that looks suspicious, right? Those are the kinds of things you can do as an organization. As a consumer, I would just say, for consumers, don't worry about it too much right now. Wait and see what government says.
Cybersecurity expert Jen Ellis. A watch that the late US President John F. Kennedy once lost at cards is to be auctioned at Christie's in New York on Monday, with some reports saying it could sell for as much as $2 million. As Alison Davis reports, the timepiece has had a checkered history since it left JFK's wrist in the early 1940s.
The gold-plated Swiss-made Bulova watch began its life as a Christmas present to the 25-year-old JFK in 1942, with a date and his initials engraved on the back. But its time with JFK was short-lived, leaving him when he reportedly lost a game of cards. So started a life of changing wrists, descending from the promising high with the future president to, in 1998, a Boston pawn shop. It was bought by a German tourist for a reported $280, who then sold it to the Austrian watch specialist Heinrich Huttner. he saw it had potential, but couldn't prove that it had belonged to John F. Kennedy. Then, after years of research, he got access to an archive of some 5,000 photos of the Kennedy family in the early 1940s. Mr. Huttner pored through them one by one, and finally one photo emerged. It shows a young JFK staring at the camera with, on his wrist, the Bulova. The photo is Heinrich Huttner's key to potentially $2 million, the starting price at the auction, $720,000. He is quoted as saying that without it, the watch was worth nothing. Now it's worth a fortune.
Alison Davis. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back at the same time tomorrow. This edition was mixed by Graham White and produced by Oliver Berlau. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.